Today, he continues, intellectual life in universities has been reduced to bare bones classroom activity. Extracurricular seminars and workshops have migrated to hotels. Workshop attendance goes with transport allowances and per diem. All this is part of a larger process, the NGOization of the university. Academic papers have turned into corporate-style PowerPoint presentations. Academics read less and less. A chorus of buzzwords have taken the place of lively debates. Now, I'm sure Mamdani's characterization could be critiqued and would be critiqued by lots of people. It's a particularly strong view. But perhaps even more important is the nature of the Western academy. Internationalism in Western academia is still a very limited cosmopolitanism, and some of us were talking last night over a beer about what internationalism actually meant, particularly in the Anglo-American system. Internationalism in the Anglo-American system normally means Anglo-American, let alone Europe, let alone anyone further afield. And we were thinking about ref categories particularly. One UK geographer who'd spent time in the University of Dar es Salaam in the 1970s sees a discipline that it's turned its back on Africa. He said, if you look at the history of British geography, geographers in Africa, then it's full of people who actually did 1 or 2 years in Africa, and he lists off a great list of names. Loads of them. But after me, I think, well, it really was the last of 20 years worth of British geographers who came to Africa, and I think if I'd not moved on, I would have never gone back to UK in an academic job. And I can't see that improving because there are now so few British academics who have an African experience or indeed the slightest bit of interest in Africa. So I don't think it's going to improve, to be honest, and that's a shame. It really is a shame. And I think the debates and the things that most Tanzanian academics are interested in are very different, geographers at least, from the vast majority of geographers in, well, I'm not even going to say Europe, but in the UK and the United States. Final slide. So post-colonialism has been critiqued for its armchair theorizing and the fact that for post-colonialism to become established, third world academics had to take up residence in the first world. Yet in the years following independence, Pan-Africanism and other subaltern geopolitics forged around non-alignment created grounded, embedded alternative reworkings of Western political thought and practice. Moreover, the margins were seen, however briefly, as offering the future center. People were drawn to Africa from both West and East superpowers. Thus, Tanzania in the 1970s presented a material provincializing of Europe, as Chakrabarty has put it, as intellectuals from the North moved to participate in and learn from Nyerere's Tanzania. The Western academics at the university in the 1970s, by definition, were privileged, but their disrupting of some of the geographies and epistemologies of Westernization that had dominated allowed for solidarities, creating a collaborative and often tentative model of post-colonial politics in the conventional sense. One Tanzanian woman who'd been involved at the time told me, it was a very, very special time for us in Africa, I would say, not only in Tanzania. The kind of lecturers who came, they were from the West, but the West that believed in the liberation of Southern Africa, which believed that this apartheid system must go. It was full of value. In the 70s, Tanzania was at the center of the decolonization movement. So I don't think it was a simple case of westernized knowledge coming to Tanzania and colonizing debates. Nyerere reworked Western political concepts, especially nationalism, in an attempt to forge a modern African future, and many of the Western academics and the debates they took home were profoundly Tanzania-ized, if that's a word. So these aren't, I don't think, stories of internationalism from below, as others have told, but rather geographies that have been recast from the margins, from and by people who've been differently entangled within networks of domination and resistance, who can neither be seen as below or outside, but nor could they be seen as powerful, central, or dominant. And of course, this is the majority experience. Postcolonial Tanzania provides a particularly clear example of how people were attempting to remake the world, perhaps because for many it was so clearly their stated goal. But I would argue that this wasn't necessarily unique. And it is an important counter to accounts of internationalism, geopolitics, and cosmopolitanism, which place the subaltern and political action emanating from this position as place-bound. As outlined in the writings of Julius Nyerere, attempts through his policies and lived by those at the University of Dar es Salaam, these subaltern geopolitics present a kind of post-colonial subjectivity within which subjects are reconstituted through recognition of shared vulnerability to the international and a shared desire to change this, to challenge this situation and even to change it. It wasn't an identity premised on the exclusion of otherness. Nyerere recognised this very clearly, and in his address to the UN following Tanganyika's independence from Britain, he stated, "I congratulate the British for taking yet a further step towards their own achievement of complete independence and freedom, because I believe that no country is completely free if it keeps other people in a state of unfreedom." Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Jo's paper and her recent scholarship more broadly pushes us to think further about subaltern marginality. What is it, where is it, and why it is important? Her paper uses the example of Tanzania to make an argument about the flows of geopolitical ideas, and especially the parts of these flows that are too often left out of sight of Anglo-American political geography. I share this intellectual project. In these comments, I suggest some ways in which Jo's analysis can be extended in political geography and used in different contexts. I underscore the ways in which ideas travel and how a closer attention to these travels can enrich our understanding of politics. The concept of the subaltern entered human geography through post-colonial scholarship, and that trajectory is still visible in the ways in which the concept is used today. Following Jo's analysis, I use the term to accentuate the subaltern as one of lower rank. In my analysis then, and in many others since Gramsci coined the term, the subaltern is not necessarily elsewhere. She is just lower ranked and hence less visible. The central feature of the subaltern condition is a specific relationship to hegemonic practices. As Mohamed Ayoub reminds us, subalternity is the common experience of most members of most societies. In other words, for most people, most of the time. If we recognize this, we can build better societies and lives on the basis of this shared vulnerability. To highlight this is not to glamorize the lower ranks and not to downplay the real differences in people's lives in different places. It is rather to highlight family resemblances among these places and processes. When Kenneth Waltz, the realist, and Jo cites him, when Kenneth Waltz, the realist, says that Denmark does not matter, the example is not insignificant. Waltz would not say that India does not matter. My point is not that India is not subaltern, but that Denmark is lower ranked too, in different ways than India, but in lower rank, relative to hegemonic understandings of geopolitics. Marginality, again, is a relationship to power. Much of post-colonial scholarship does not simply study post-colonial societies outside the West, but rather focuses on the exchange between the so-called West and the so-called non-West. Exchange that happens to the extent that the West is far less distinctly Western than it seems, and the non-West becomes less distinctly non-Western than first meets the eye. When James Tyner and others say that Western scholars should be more knowledgeable about pan-African nationalisms, I agree with them. However, that understanding requires not just learning about Africa, but learning about the travels of concepts like nationalism, the ways in which pan-Africanism or pan-African nationalism works with other pans, such as pan-Europeanism or pan-Slavism, and with the idea of community that was created by the Enlightenment and by nationalism in Europe. Subaltern thinking of liberty or community works with these ideas too. The point is not that one happened first and is therefore more authentic, but rather that they emerge from a shared sense of vulnerability, and their authorship, the authorship of these ideas, whether pan-Europeanism, pan-Africanism, today is not limited to Europe or any other place. Pan-Europeanism, for example, as it emerged after World War I, also grew out of a sense of loss. It emerged from the margins of power politics and it remained there. In a similar way, when Nyerere speaks about the possibility of peace in a violently divided world, I am struck by how similar his pragmatism is to someone like Jean Monnet. The point is certainly not that Nyerere follows Monnet, but that marginality is not confined to the places that immediately look marginal to Western academics. If Perry has a point, and that's an if, in that Anglo-American political geography largely ignores the concerns of 4/5 of humankind, then this is not simply because it studies limited number of places. The bigger problem, I think, is that Anglo-American political geography often holds up a simplistic and impoverished idea of the West, and this leads it to a simplistic and impoverished idea of the non-West, and the other way around, of course. Those concepts are linked. Let me make it clear that I do not accuse Jo of doing this. I build on her analysis to counter such simplifications. I know I tried to take Jo's work elsewhere. So the question then is, how might we encounter these simplifications? And how might we produce a richer understanding of power and resistance? We can do comparative analysis that investigate the discursive field in which specific power relationships come into being. In particular, I urge further analysis of how ideas travel, and there is now a literature on this in geography and beyond. Pinar Bilgin, another author Jo cites, does just that in some of her work. Bilgin does not prioritize Western or Turkish geopolitics in her work. She's unconcerned with the origins of ideas. She's rather interested in the travel of ideas, the citational practices between Europe and Turkey in her case. Or we can follow Kate Brown, who bravely argues that Montana and Kazakhstan are nearly the same place. Brown is not arrogantly suggesting that differences do not matter. She rather argues that lives in both places have been gridded by state-sponsored violence. In another study, Brown speaks of the borderlands of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires, of Soviet Union and Poland after that, and of Ukraine and Poland today as a no place. She calls the place a no place because in hegemonic understandings of politics and belonging, that place does not exist. Moving to elite circles, Catherine Verdery shows the movement of former colonial officials into the management of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. This had far-reaching effects on Europe as one of the main theaters of the Cold War, as literally former colonial officials started to manage Europe as a theater of the Cold War. And just like elites in Africa tried to maneuver in these conditions, so did elites in Europe. The process continues today. Speaking of Polish elites of the early 1990s, Janine Wedel observes, quote, that charming, understated style in which the savvy elites of poor countries often present themselves, unquote. Wedel could have said the same about many other places in Europe and elsewhere. Or we can follow Paul-Henri Spaak, former Prime Minister of Belgium, who said, quote, Europe consists only of small countries, some of which know it and some of which don't yet, unquote. Where is the non-lower ranked in these examples? In Europe, a Ruthenian would be baffled by such a suggestion. True, we do not hear about subaltern experience in Ruthenia. Perhaps we just don't look there. There are certainly some higher ranked places in Europe, but there are also a whole lot of lower ranked ones that tend to not exist in our habitual ways of thinking about the continent. Reading Jo's paper from Europe, or from Eastern Europe more specifically, I was reminded of many things in Europe, the nationalism, the transnationalism, and the great power games that frame these pursuits. What I have tried to do here is to think where we could take Joe's analysis. We can take it to many places, including Europe. This is not... Okay. Well, thank you. Joe's paper and her recent scholarship more broadly pushes us to think further about subaltern marginality. What is it, where is it, and why it is important? Her paper uses the example of Tanzania to make an argument about the flows of geopolitical ideas, and especially the parts of these flows that are too often left out of sight of Anglo-American political geography. I share this intellectual project. In these comments, I suggest some ways in which Joe's analysis can be extended in political geography and used in different contexts. I underscore the ways in which ideas travel and how a closer attention to these travels can enrich our understanding of politics. The concept of the subaltern entered human geography through post-colonial scholarship, and that trajectory is still visible in the ways in which the concept is used today. Following Joe's analysis, I use the term to accentuate the subaltern as one of lower rank. In my analysis then, and in many others since Gramsci coined the term, the subaltern is not necessarily elsewhere. She is just lower ranked and hence less visible. The central feature of the subaltern condition is a specific relationship to hegemonic practices. As Mohamed Ayoub reminds us, subalternity is the common experience of most members of most societies. In other words, for most people most of the time. If we recognize this, we can build better societies and lives on the basis of this shared vulnerability. To highlight this is not to glamorize the lower ranks and not to downplay the real differences in people's lives in different places. It is rather to highlight family resemblances among these places and processes. When Kenneth Waltz, the realist, and Joe cites him, when Kenneth Waltz, the realist, says that Denmark does not matter, the example is not insignificant. Waltz would not say that India does not matter. My point is not that India is not subaltern, but that Denmark is lower ranked too, in different ways than India, but in lower rank, relative to hegemonic understandings of geopolitics. Marginality, again, is a relationship to power. Much of post-colonial scholarship does not simply study post-colonial societies outside the West, but rather focuses on the exchange between the so-called West and the so-called non-West. Exchange that happens to the extent that the West is far less distinctly Western than it seems, and the non-West becomes less distinctly non-Western than first meets the eye. When James Tyner and others say that Western scholars should be more knowledgeable about Pan-African nationalisms, I agree with them. However, that understanding requires not just learning about Africa, but learning about the travels of concepts like nationalism, the ways in which Pan-Africanism or Pan-African nationalism works with other pans, such as Pan-Europeanism or Pan-Slavism, and with the idea of community that was created by the Enlightenment and by nationalism in Europe. Subaltern thinking of liberty or community works with these ideas too. The point is not that one happened first and is therefore more authentic, but rather that they emerge from a shared sense of vulnerability, and their authorship, the authorship of these ideas, whether pan-Europeanism, pan-Africanism, today is not limited to Europe or any other place. Pan-Europeanism, for example, as it emerged after World War I, also grew out of a sense of loss. It emerged from the margins of power politics, and it remained there. In a similar way, when Nyerere speaks about the possibility of peace in a violently divided world, I am struck by how similar his pragmatism is to someone like Jean Monnet. The point is certainly not that Nyerere follows Monet, but that marginality is not confined to the places that immediately look marginal to Western academics. If Perry has a point, and that's an if, in that Anglo-American political geography largely ignores the concerns of four-fifths of humankind, then this is not simply because it studies limited number of places. The bigger problem, I think, is that Anglo-American political geography often holds up a simplistic and impoverished idea of the West, and this leads it to a simplistic and impoverished idea of the non-West, and the other way around, of course, those concepts are linked. Let me make it clear that I do not accuse Jo of doing this. I build on her analysis to counter such simplifications. I know I tried to take Jo's work elsewhere. So the question then is, how might we encounter these simplifications, and how might we produce a richer understanding of power and resistance? We can do comparative analysis that investigate the discursive fields in which specific power relationships come into being. In particular, I urge further analysis of how ideas travel, and there is now a literature on this in geography and beyond. Pinar Bilgin, another author Jo cites, does just that in some of her work. Bilgin does not prioritize Western or Turkish geopolitics in her work. She's unconcerned with the origins of ideas. She's rather interested in the travel of ideas, the citational practices between Europe and Turkey, in her case. Or we can follow Kate Brown, who bravely argues that Montana and Kazakhstan are nearly the same place. Brown is not arrogantly suggesting that differences do not matter. She rather argues that lives in both places have been gridded by state-sponsored violence. In another study, Brown speaks of the borderlands of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires, of Soviet Union and Poland after that, and of Ukraine and Poland today as a no place. She calls the place a no place because in hegemonic understandings of politics and belonging, that place does not exist. Moving to elite circles, Catherine Verdery shows the movement of former colonial officials into the management of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. This had far-reaching effects on Europe as one of the main theaters of the Cold War, as literally former colonial officials started to manage Europe as a theater of the Cold War. And just like elites in Africa tried to maneuver in these conditions, so did elites in Europe. The process continues today. Speaking of Polish elites of the early 1990s, Janine Wedel observes, quote, that charming, understated style in which the savvy elites of poor countries often present themselves, unquote. Wedel could have said the same about many other places in Europe and elsewhere. Or we can follow Paul-Henri Spaak, former Prime Minister of Belgium, who said, quote, Europe consists only of small countries, some of which know it and some of which don't yet, unquote. Where is the non-lower ranked in these examples? In Europe, a Ruthenian would be baffled by such a suggestion. True, we do not hear about subaltern experience in Ruthenia. Perhaps we just don't look there. There are certainly some higher ranked places in Europe, but there are also a whole lot of lower ranked ones that tend to not exist in our habitual ways of thinking about the continent. Reading Jo's paper from Europe, or from Eastern Europe more specifically, I was reminded of many things in Europe, the nationalism, the transnationalism, and the great power games that frame these pursuits. What I have tried to do here is to think where we could take Jo's analysis. We can take it to many places, including Europe. This is not... Okay. Well, thank you. Jo's paper and her recent scholarship more broadly pushes us to think further about subaltern marginality. What is it, where is it, and why it is important? Her paper uses the example of Tanzania to make an argument about the flows of geopolitical ideas, and especially the parts of these flows that are too often left out of sight of Anglo-American political geography. I share this intellectual project. In these comments, I suggest some ways in which Jo's analysis can be extended in political geography and used in different contexts. I underscore the ways in which ideas travel and how a closer attention to these travels can enrich our understanding of politics. The concept of the subaltern entered human geography through postcolonial scholarship, and that trajectory is still visible in the ways in which the concept is used today. Following Jo's analysis, I use the term to accentuate the subaltern as one of lower rank. In my analysis then, and in many others since Gramsci coined the term, the subaltern is not necessarily elsewhere. She is just lower ranked and hence less visible. The central feature of the subaltern condition is a specific relationship to hegemonic practices. As Mohamed Ayoub reminds us, subalterity is the common experience of most members of most societies. In other words, for most people, most of the time. If we recognize this, we can build better societies and lives on the basis of this shared vulnerability. To highlight this is not to glamorize the lower ranks and not to downplay the real differences in people's lives in different places. It is rather to highlight family resemblances among these places and processes. When Kenneth Waltz, the realist, and Jo cites him, when Kenneth Waltz, the realist, says that Denmark does not matter, the example is not insignificant. Waltz would not say that India does not matter. My point is not that India is not subaltern, but that Denmark is lower ranked too, in different ways than India, but in lower rank, relative to hegemonic understandings of geopolitics. Marginality, again, is a relationship to power. Much of postcolonial scholarship does not simply study postcolonial societies outside the West, but rather focuses on the exchange between the so-called West and the so-called non-West. Exchange that happens to the extent that the West is far less distinctly Western than it seems, and the non-West becomes less distinctly non-Western than first meets the eye. When James Tyner and others say that Western scholars should be more knowledgeable about Pan-African nationalisms, I agree with them. However, that understanding requires not just learning about Africa, but learning about the travels of concepts like nationalism, the ways in which Pan-Africanism or Pan-African nationalism works with other pans, such as Pan-Europeanism or Pan-Slavism, and with the idea of community that was created by the Enlightenment and by nationalism in Europe. Subaltern thinking of liberty or community works with these ideas too. The point is not that one happened first and is therefore more authentic, but rather that they emerge from a shared sense of vulnerability, and their authorship, the authorship of these ideas, whether pan-Europeanism, pan-Africanism, today is not limited to Europe or any other place. Pan-Europeanism, for example, as it emerged after World War I, also grew out of a sense of loss. It emerged from the margins of power politics and it remained there. In a similar way, when Nyerere speaks about the possibility of peace in a violently divided world, I am struck by how similar his pragmatism is to someone like Jean Monnet. The point is certainly not that Nyerere follows Monnet, but that marginality is not confined to the places that immediately look marginal to Western academics. If Perry has a point, and that's an if, in that Anglo-American political geography largely ignores the concerns of four-fifths of humankind, then this is not simply because it studies limited number of places. The bigger problem, I think, is that Anglo-American political geography often holds up a simplistic and impoverished idea of the West, and this leads it to a simplistic and impoverished idea of the non-West, and the other way around, of course. Those concepts are linked. Let me make it clear that I do not accuse Jo of doing this. I build on her analysis to counter such simplifications. I, in a way, tried to take Jo's work elsewhere. So the question then is, how might we encounter these simplifications, and how might we produce a richer understanding of power and resistance? We can do comparative analysis that investigate the discursive fields in which specific power relationships come into being. In particular, I urge further analysis of how ideas travel, and there is now a literature on this in geography and beyond. Pinar Bilgin, another author Jo cites, does just that in some of her work. Bilgin does not prioritize Western or Turkish geopolitics in her work. She's unconcerned with the origins of ideas. She's rather interested in the travel of ideas, the citational practices between Europe and Turkey in her case. Or we can follow Kate Brown, who bravely argues that Montana and Kazakhstan are nearly the same place. Brown is not arrogantly suggesting that differences do not matter. She rather argues that lives in both places have been gridded by state-sponsored violence. In another study, Brown speaks of the borderlands of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires, of Soviet Union and Poland after that, and of Ukraine and Poland today as a no place. She calls the place a no place because in hegemonic understandings of politics and belonging, that place does not exist. Moving to elite circles, Catherine Verdery shows the movement of former colonial officials into the management of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. This had far-reaching effects on Europe as one of the main theaters of the Cold War, as literally former colonial officials started to manage Europe as a theater of the Cold War. And just like elites in Africa tried to maneuver in these conditions, so did elites in Europe. The process continues today. Speaking of Polish elites of the early 1990s, Janine Wedel observes, quote, that charming, understated style in which the savvy elites of poor countries often present themselves, unquote. Wedel could have said the same about many other places in Europe and elsewhere. Or we can follow Paul-Henri Spaak, former Prime Minister of Belgium, who said, quote, Europe consists only of small countries, some of which know it and some of which don't yet, unquote. Where is the non-lower ranked in these examples? In Europe, a Ruthenian would be baffled by such a suggestion. True, we do not hear about subaltern experience in Ruthenia. Perhaps we just don't look there. There are certainly some higher ranked places in Europe, but there are also a whole lot of lower ranked ones that tend to not exist in our habitual ways of thinking about the continent. Reading Jo's paper from Europe, or from Eastern Europe more specifically, I was reminded of many things in Europe, the nationalism, the transnationalism, and the great power games that frame these pursuits. What I have tried to do here is to think where we could take Jo's analysis. We can take it to many places, including Europe. This is not, okay. Well, thank you. Jo's paper and her recent scholarship more broadly pushes us to think further about subaltern marginality. What is it, where is it, and why it is important? Her paper uses the example of Tanzania to make an argument about the flows of geopolitical ideas, and especially the parts of these flows that are too often left out of sight of Anglo-American political geography. I share this intellectual project. In these comments, I suggest some ways in which Joe's analysis can be extended in political geography and used in different contexts. I underscore the ways in which ideas travel and how a closer attention to these travels can enrich our understanding of politics. The concept of the subaltern entered human geography through postcolonial scholarship, and that trajectory is still visible in the ways in which the concept is used today. Following Joe's analysis, I use the term to accentuate the subaltern as one of lower rank. In my analysis then, and in many others since Gramsci coined the term, the subaltern is not necessarily elsewhere. She's just lower ranked and hence less visible. The central feature of the subaltern condition is a specific relationship to hegemonic practices. As Mohammed Ayoub reminds us, subalterity is the common experience of most members of most societies. In other words, for most people most of the time. If we recognize this, we can build better societies and lives on the basis of this shared vulnerability. To highlight this is not to glamorize the lower ranks and not to downplay the real differences in people's lives in different places. It is rather to highlight family resemblances among these places and processes. When Kenneth Waltz, the realist, and Joe cites him, when Kenneth Waltz, the realist, says that Denmark does not matter, the example is not insignificant. Waltz would not say that India does not matter. My point is not that India is not subaltern, but that Denmark is lower ranked too, in different ways than India, but in lower rank, relative to hegemonic understandings of geopolitics. Marginality, again, is a relationship to power. Much of postcolonial scholarship does not simply study postcolonial societies outside the West, but rather focuses on the exchange between the so-called West and the so-called non-West. Exchange that happens to the extent that the West is far less distinctly Western than it seems, and the non-West becomes less distinctly non-Western than first meets the eye. When James Tyner and others say that Western scholars should be more knowledgeable about Pan-African nationalisms, I agree with them. However, that understanding requires not just learning about Africa, but learning about the travels of concepts like nationalism, the ways in which Pan-Africanism or Pan-African nationalism works with other pans, such as Pan-Europeanism or Pan-Slavism, and with the idea of community that was created by the Enlightenment and by nationalism in Europe. Subaltern thinking of liberty or community works with these ideas too. The point is not that one happened first and is therefore more authentic, but rather that they emerge from a shared sense of vulnerability, and their authorship, the authorship of these ideas, whether pan-Europeanism, pan-Africanism, today is not limited to Europe or any other place. Pan-Europeanism, for example, as it emerged after World War I, also grew out of a sense of loss. It emerged from the margins of power politics, and it remained there. In a similar way, when Nyerere speaks about the possibility of peace in a violently divided world, I am struck by how similar his pragmatism is to someone like Jean Monnet. The point is certainly not that Nyerere follows Monet, but that marginality is not confined to the places that immediately look marginal to Western academics. If Perry has a point, and that's an if, in that Anglo-American political geography largely ignores the concerns of four-fifths of humankind, then this is not simply because it studies limited number of places. The bigger problem, I think, is that Anglo-American political geography often holds up a simplistic and impoverished idea of the West and this leads it to a simplistic and impoverished idea of the non-West, and the other way around, of course. Those concepts are linked. Let me make it clear that I do not accuse Jo of doing this. I build on her analysis to counter such simplifications. I know I tried to take Jo's work elsewhere. So the question then is, how might we encounter these simplifications, and how might we produce a richer understanding of power and resistance? We can do comparative analysis that investigate the discursive field in which specific power relationships come into being. In particular, I urge further analysis of how ideas travel, and there is now a literature on this in geography and beyond. Pinar Bilgin, another author Jo cites, does just that in some of her work. Bilgin does not prioritize Western or Turkish geopolitics in her work. She's unconcerned with the origins of ideas. She's rather interested in the travel of ideas, the citational practices between Europe and Turkey in her case. Or we can follow Kate Brown, who bravely argues that Montana and Kazakhstan are nearly the same place. Brown is not arrogantly suggesting that differences do not matter. She rather argues that lives in both places have been gridded by state-sponsored violence. In another study, Brown speaks of the borderlands of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires, of Soviet Union and Poland after that, and of Ukraine and Poland today as a no place. She calls the place a no place because in hegemonic understandings of politics and belonging, that place does not exist. Moving to elite circles, Catherine Verdery shows the movement of former colonial officials into the management of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. This had far-reaching effects on Europe as one of the main theaters of the Cold War, as literally former colonial officials started to manage Europe as a theater of the Cold War. And just like elites in Africa tried to maneuver in these conditions, so did elites in Europe. The process continues today. Speaking of Polish elites of the early 1990s, Janine Waddell observes, quote, that charming, understated style in which the savvy elites of poor countries often present themselves, unquote. Waddell could have said the same about many other places in Europe and elsewhere. Or we can follow Paul-Henri Spaak, former Prime Minister of Belgium, who said, quote, Europe consists only of small countries, some of which know it and some of which don't yet, unquote. Where is the non-lower ranked in these examples? In Europe, a Ruthenian would be baffled by such a suggestion. True, we do not hear about subaltern experience in Ruthenia. Perhaps we just don't look there. There are certainly some higher ranked places in Europe, but there are also a whole lot of lower ranked ones that tend to not exist in our habitual ways of thinking about the continent. Reading Jo's paper from Europe, or from Eastern Europe more specifically, I was reminded of many things in Europe, the nationalism, the transnationalism, and the great power games that frame these pursuits. What I have tried to do here is to think where we could take Jo's analysis. We can take it to many places, including Europe. This is not... Okay. Well, thank you. Jo's paper and her recent scholarship more broadly pushes us to think further about subaltern marginality. What is it, where is it, and why it is important? Her paper uses the example of Tanzania to make an argument about the flows of geopolitical ideas, and especially the parts of these flows that are too often left out of sight of Anglo-American political geography. I share this intellectual project. In these comments, I suggest some ways in which Jo's analysis can be extended in political geography and used in different contexts. I underscore the ways in which ideas travel and how a closer attention to these travels can enrich our understanding of politics. The concept of the subaltern entered human geography through postcolonial scholarship, and that trajectory is still visible in the ways in which the concept is used today. Following Joe's analysis, I use the term to accentuate the subaltern as one of lower rank. In my analysis then, and in many others since Gramsci coined the term, the subaltern is not necessarily elsewhere. She is just lower ranked and hence less visible. The central feature of the subaltern condition is a specific relationship to hegemonic practices. As Mohammed Ayoub reminds us, subalternity is the common experience of most members of most societies. In other words, for most people, most of the time. If we recognize this, we can build better societies and lives on the basis of this shared vulnerability. To highlight this is not to glamorize the lower ranks and not to downplay the real differences in people's lives in different places. It is rather to highlight family resemblances among these places and processes. When Kenneth Waltz, the realist, and Joe cites him, when Kenneth Waltz, the realist, says that Denmark does not matter, the example is not insignificant. Waltz would not say that India does not matter. My point is not that India is not subaltern, but that Denmark is lower ranked too, in different ways than India, but in lower rank, relative to hegemonic understandings of geopolitics. Marginality, again, is a relationship to power. Much of postcolonial scholarship does not simply study postcolonial societies outside the West, but rather focuses on the exchange between the so-called West and the so-called non-West. Exchange that happens to the extent that the West is far less distinctly Western than it seems, and the non-West becomes less distinctly non-Western than first meets the eye. When James Tyner and others say that Western scholars should be more knowledgeable about Pan-African nationalisms, I agree with them. However, that understanding requires not just learning about Africa, but learning about the travels of concepts like nationalism, the ways in which Pan-Africanism or Pan-African nationalism works with other pans, such as Pan-Europeanism or Pan-Slavism, and with the idea of community that was created by the Enlightenment and by nationalism in Europe. Subaltern thinking of liberty or community works with these ideas too. The point is not that one happened first and is therefore more authentic, but rather that they emerge from a shared sense of vulnerability and their authorship, the authorship of these ideas, whether pan-Europeanism, pan-Africanism, today is not limited to Europe or any other place. Pan-Europeanism, for example, as it emerged after World War I, also grew out of a sense of loss. It emerged from the margins of power politics and it remained there. In a similar way, when Nyerere speaks about the possibility of peace in a violently divided world, I am struck by how similar his pragmatism is to someone like Jean Monnet. The point is certainly not that Nyerere follows Monnet, but that marginality is not confined to the places that immediately look marginal to Western academics. If Perry has a point, and that's an if, in that Anglo-American political geography largely ignores the concerns of 4/5 of humankind, then this is not simply because it studies limited number of places. The bigger problem, I think, is that Anglo-American political geography often holds up a simplistic and impoverished idea of the West, and this leads it to a simplistic and impoverished idea of the non-West, and the other way around, of course, those concepts are linked. Let me make it clear that I do not accuse Jo of doing this. I build on her analysis to counter such simplifications. I, in a way, try to take Jo's work elsewhere. So the question then is, how might we encounter these simplifications, and how might we produce a richer understanding of power and resistance? We can do comparative analysis that investigate the discursive fields in which specific power relationships come into being. In particular, I urge further analysis of how ideas travel, and there is now a literature on this in geography and beyond. Pinar Bilgin, another author Joe cites, does just that in some of her work. Bilgin does not prioritize Western or Turkish geopolitics in her work. She's unconcerned with the origins of ideas. She's rather interested in the travel of ideas, the citational practices between Europe and Turkey, in her case. Or we can follow Kate Brown, who bravely argues that Montana and Kazakhstan are nearly the same place. Brown is not arrogantly suggesting that differences do not matter. She rather argues that lives in both places have been gridded by state-sponsored violence. In another study, Brown speaks of the borderlands of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires, of Soviet Union and Poland after that, and of Ukraine and Poland today as a no place. She calls the place a no place because in hegemonic understandings of politics and belonging, that place does not exist. Moving to elite circles, Catherine Verdery shows the movement of former colonial officials into the management of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. This had far-reaching effects on Europe as one of the main theaters of the Cold War, as literally former colonial officials started to manage Europe as a theater of the Cold War. And just like elites in Africa tried to maneuver in these conditions, so did elites in Europe. The process continues today. Speaking of Polish elites of the early 1990s, Janine Waddell observes, quote, that charming, understated style in which the savvy elites of poor countries often present themselves, unquote. Waddell could have said the same about many other places in Europe and elsewhere. Or we can follow Paul-Henri Spaak, former Prime Minister of Belgium, who said, quote, Europe consists only of small countries, some of which know it and some of which don't yet, unquote. Where is the non-lower ranked in these examples? In Europe, a Ruthenian would be baffled by such a suggestion. True, we do not hear about subaltern experience in Ruthenia. Perhaps we just don't look there. There are certainly some higher ranked places in Europe, but there are also a whole lot of lower ranked ones that tend to not exist in our habitual ways of thinking about the continent. Reading Joe's paper from Europe, or from Eastern Europe more specifically, I was reminded of many things in Europe, the nationalism, the transnationalism, and the great power games that frame these pursuits. What I have tried to do here is to think where we could take Joe's analysis. We can take it to many places, including Europe. This is not... Okay. Well, thank you. Joe's paper and her recent scholarship more broadly pushes us to think further about subaltern marginality. What is it, where is it, and why it is important? Her paper uses the example of Tanzania to make an argument about the flows of geopolitical ideas, and especially the parts of these flows that are too often left out of sight of Anglo-American political geography. I share this intellectual project. In these comments, I suggest some ways in which Joe's analysis can be extended in political geography and used in different contexts. I underscore the ways in which ideas travel and how a closer attention to these travels can enrich our understanding of politics. The concept of the subaltern entered human geography through post-colonial scholarship And that trajectory is still visible in the ways in which the concept is used today. Following Joe's analysis, I use the term to accentuate the subaltern as one of lower rank. In my analysis then, and in many others since Gramsci coined the term, the subaltern is not necessarily elsewhere. She is just lower ranked and hence less visible. The central feature of the subaltern condition is a specific relationship to hegemonic practices. As Mohammed Ayoub reminds us, subalterity is the common experience of most members of most societies. In other words, for most people most of the time. If we recognize this, we can build better societies and lives on the basis of this shared vulnerability. To highlight this is not to glamorize the lower ranks and not to downplay the real differences in people's lives in different places. It is rather to highlight family resemblances among these places and processes. When Kenneth Waltz, the realist, and Joe cites him, when Kenneth Waltz, the realist, says that Denmark does not matter, the example is not insignificant. Waltz would not say that India does not matter. My point is not that India is not subaltern, but that Denmark is lower ranked too, in different ways than India, but in lower rank, relative to hegemonic understandings of geopolitics. Marginality, again, is a relationship to power. Much of postcolonial scholarship does not simply study postcolonial societies outside the West, but rather focuses on the exchange between the so-called West and the so-called non-West. Exchange that happens to the extent that the West is far less distinctly Western than it seems, and the non-West becomes less distinctly non-Western than first meets the eye. When James Tyner and others say that Western scholars should be more knowledgeable about Pan-African nationalisms, I agree with them. However, that understanding requires not just learning about Africa, but learning about the travels of concepts like nationalism, the ways in which Pan-Africanism or Pan-African nationalism works with other pans, such as Pan-Europeanism or Pan-Slavism, and with the idea of community that was created by the Enlightenment and by nationalism in Europe. Subaltern thinking of liberty or community works with these ideas too. The point is not that one happened first and is therefore more authentic, but rather that they emerge from a shared sense of vulnerability and their authorship, the authorship of these ideas, whether pan-Europeanism, pan-Africanism, today is not limited to Europe or any other place. Pan-Europeanism, for example, as it emerged after World War I, also grew out of a sense of loss. It emerged from the margins of power politics and it remained there. In a similar way, when Nyerere speaks about the possibility of peace in a violently divided world, I am struck by how similar his pragmatism is to someone like Jean Monnet. The point is certainly not that Nyerere follows Monnet, but that marginality is not confined to the places that immediately look marginal to Western academics. If Perry has a point, and that's an if, in that Anglo-American political geography largely ignores the concerns of four-fifths of humankind, then this is not simply because it studies limited number of places. The bigger problem, I think, is that Anglo-American political geography often holds up a simplistic and impoverished idea of the West, and this leads it to a simplistic and impoverished idea of the non-West, and the other way around, of course, those concepts are linked. Let me make it clear that I do not accuse Jo of doing this. I build on her analysis to counter such simplifications. I, in a way, try to take Jo's work elsewhere. So the question then is, how might we encounter these simplifications and how might we produce a richer understanding of power and resistance? We can do comparative analysis that investigate the discursive field in which specific power relationships come into being. In particular, I urge further analysis of how ideas travel, and there is now a literature on this in geography and beyond. Pinar Bilgin, another author Joe cites, does just that in some of her work. Bilgin does not prioritize Western or Turkish geopolitics in her work. She's unconcerned with the origins of ideas. She's rather interested in the travel of ideas, the citational practices between Europe and Turkey in her case. Or we can follow Kate Brown, who bravely argues that Montana and Kazakhstan are nearly the same place. Brown is not arrogantly suggesting that differences do not matter. She rather argues that lives in both places have been gridded by state-sponsored violence. In another study, Brown speaks of the borderlands of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires, of Soviet Union and Poland after that, and of Ukraine and Poland today as a no place. She calls the place a no place because in hegemonic understandings of politics and belonging, that place does not exist. Moving to elite circles, Catherine Verdery shows the movement of former colonial officials into the management of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. This had far-reaching effects on Europe as one of the main theaters of the Cold War, as literally former colonial officials started to manage Europe as a theater of the Cold War. And just like elites in Africa tried to maneuver in these conditions, so did elites in Europe. The process continues today. Speaking of Polish elites of the early 1990s, Janine Wedel observes, quote, that charming, understated style in which the savvy elites of poor countries often present themselves, unquote. Wedel could have said the same about many other places in Europe and elsewhere. Or we can follow Paul-Henri Spaak, former Prime Minister of Belgium, who said, quote, Europe consists only of small countries, some of which know it and some of which don't yet, unquote. Where is the non-lower ranked in these examples? In Europe, a Ruthenian would be baffled by such a suggestion. True, we do not hear about subaltern experience in Ruthenia. Perhaps we just don't look there. There are certainly some higher ranked places in Europe, but there are also a whole lot of lower ranked ones that tend to not exist in our habitual ways of thinking about the continent. Reading Joe's paper from Europe, or from Eastern Europe more specifically, I was reminded of many things in Europe, the nationalism, the transnationalism, and the great power games that frame these pursuits. What I have tried to do here is to think where we could take Joe's analysis. We can take it to many places, including Europe. This is not